As Charles then undertook to remain with Bill, saying he knew only too well what the poor devil was suffering, I went back to the scene of the raid to see if I could be of any further assistance. An ambulance passed me, so I decided to follow it. It was driven to one of the big London hospitals and a stretcher, on which a young girl was lying, was carefully carried into the building. The same girl in her astral body was walking, in a very agitated condition, close behind the stretcher. After examination, the body of the girl was carried into one of the wards, already filled with recent casualties. Without any fuss or hurry and an efficiency at which I greatly marveled, the girl was put to bed and arrangements were made for giving her a blood transfusion. She was frantically trying to communicate with the doctors and nurses attending to her unconscious body, but after a short time she listened to what I had. I told her she would be all right, for intuitively I knew this was so. I told her that it would help if she became calm and watched the proceedings, at the same time using her willpower to aid the efforts of the doctors and nurses. I don't know now why I suggested this to her. I hadn't the slightest idea whether it would help or not, but it came to me to say this, and so I did. I could see quite clearly that there was a thin line of etheric matter stretched between her astral body and physical form lying on the hospital bed, so I knew that she was not dead, and was sure she could not die. I stayed talking with her for the rest of my night, and after she had told me that the house in which she lived was next door to the one that had received a direct hit and that she was very worried indeed as to the fate of her old mother, I began to give her a little of the knowledge which had recently been given to me. There were other astral helpers moving about the ward, and one of them whom I had not seen before, but who said his name was Jim, congratulated me on my efforts, saying that he wished there were more people with the necessary knowledge who would help in similar emergencies. I had an experience so unique during Friday night that I must describe the night's activities in some detail. I found Daphne in her room at the academy. One of the first things I asked her about was her part in my nightmare, but she assured me she was not present. We decided we would try to get to the next sphere, the fourth, on our own, but were faced with the problem that neither of us had a landmark to visualize. We sat down outside and concentrated. I tried to see a mental hospital, such as Acharya had mentioned, but nothing happened. I wished we had Acharya to help us and must have made a thought form of him because, after our next attempt had failed, I heard a chuckle behind me. And there he was. He said he would help us and give us landmarks on each sphere, which we must memorize. We linked hands with him, and when I opened my eyes, the scene that met them cannot adequately be described, for it was the most beautiful valley I have ever seen. It was partly wooded and the ground was covered with thick heather of the varied colors which one sees to perfection in South Africa, but soft to the touch. Intermingled with this, wild flowers bloomed in profusion. Side by side I saw primroses, bluebells, daffodils, forget-me-nots, tulips, wild roses and the most vivid red poppies that could be imagined. I'm sure no variety of wild flower was missing, for the ground near and far was a veritable carpet of colors of breathtaking beauty. I thought you would be pleased with this landmark, said Acharya, for it is called the Fairy Glen. It could be described as the cradle of the Deva Kingdom, for it is the valley to which the members of this evolution return after they have finished the particular work allotted to them. I suggest you both investigate the valley on some future occasion quietly and unobtrusively, for the Devas have their own methods of keeping away Philistines amongst men. They build a thick wall of astral matter, which makes it impossible for any human being to see beyond, even if they knew this place existed. Such walls serve the same purpose at this level as do brick walls in the physical world. Once more we joined hands and willed ourselves to the next level, the fifth. On opening my eyes it seemed uncanny to find that we were standing on an open plain like a desert, except that there was grass in the place of sand. In the distance was a huge city, with many spires and towers, surrounded by an immense town. Above the city shone something in the nature of a sun, for it spread a glow over all the buildings, which made them shine like gold. That, my friends, is the Golden City, said our guide, and I advise you to visit and study it. You will find within everything that has ever been thought of or imagined as likely to be found in Orthodox heaven, so much talked of by priests and ministers attached to the Christian creed. The whole city is a huge thought form, and you will find therein thought forms of God the Father, of Christ and his 12 disciples, and the many saints who have figured in the teachings of the church. Again we linked hands, and wheeled ourselves to the sixth level. Within a second we were standing on the edge of the lake, which was surrounded by a high wall of rock. In the distance on our left was to be seen a very small opening. I wondered where it led. Make a clear picture of this scene, advised Acharya. This lake is used principally by members of the human race who desire absolute silence for their particular work. There is one section, the world, which evolves entirely through meditation exercises. They are taught during their lifetime that there is this place, in rather the same way that Christians are taught that there is a place called heaven. Apostrophe the small boats you see are used by the men who come here, for when they are afloat, it is impossible for one boat to be overtaken by another. This is due to some underwater currents which caused the boats to drift round the entire lake. It takes 24 hours, Earth time, for a boat to return to its starting place, and the meditation exercises carried out by these people take exactly that time to complete. I saw you notice the small opening on the left, that leads to another similar but smaller lake, also surrounded by high cliffs. This lake was produced by an individual who sojourned here. One day he was interrupted in his meditations by other human beings using the lake at the same time as himself. The thought form he made was so strong that he produced a lake call for himself. I have spoken to you here in a voice, which is hardly above a whisper. Had I spoken in my usual voice, you would have heard it reverberating, echoing, rounds the lake like thunder. The people in the vicinity know about this unusual feature, and take good care never to make sound. Because of this peculiarity, the lake is called the Waters of Perpetual Silence. Now I must leave you. You should have no difficulty in returning without my assistance. P. 142 As he had surmised, Daphne and I found no difficulty in retracing our steps, but when we reached the fourth sphere and once more saw the fairy glen, we decided to remain there for a short time. We noticed there were signs of great activity in the valley, as if some sort of ceremony were about to take place. There seemed to be thousands of inhabitants gathering in the valley. We sat down to watch. Our presence was noticed by some officials, and when one of them moved towards us, we rather expected to be asked to go away, particularly as Acharya had flamed us that members of our revolution were not always welcome here. The man who, slowly and in a dignified manner, floated towards us had a very fine intellectual head and a spiritual dignity, which made us rise to our feet instinctively as he reached us. His costume was strange to us. It resembled that of a Chinese mandarin. The colors of the long coat were exquisite, whilst the embroidery clearly portrayed many of the wild flowers that bloomed in the valley. The expression on his face did not seem to augur trouble for us, so we smiled in return, hoping that our attitude would reassure him. What followed was a little uncanny, for it was a conversation conducted without a word being uttered. Question and answer followed one upon the other, far more quickly than would have been possible had words been our medium of expression. I felt he had asked me whether he could do anything for us. I told him, merely by allowing the thought to express itself in my mind, that Daphne was a permanent inhabitant of the astral world, whereas I was still living in a physical body in the world and was here during the period when my body was sleeping. He seemed to understand perfectly, and said he had been instructed by his chief to bring us to him. We intimated that we were only too willing to accompany him and at once moved towards the central arena. As we approached, I saw that the people were standing and sitting around a large open circle. Wild flowers had been strung together to keep back the crowds, and I could not help comparing the beauty of that fence with those we see in the world. Just within the circle a dais had been erected, made entirely of great clumps of green moss with pillars at each corner, formed of intertwined flowers of every size and color. Even the awning above the dais was made of a very delicate fern, not unlike our maidenhair variety. The whole formed a most beautiful picture. The moss on the floor of the dais had been laid in such a way that there appeared to be numerous seats with shaped backs, which looked so comfortable that one immediately wished to sit down. At the front there were two large seats, almost like thrones, and, although these two were composed of moss, they were more ornate than the others. Whilst we waited for the chief to appear, our guide told us something of what was about to take place. The gist of what he said was that the crowd had gathered together to witness a graduation ceremony. He explained that when the time came for a group of nature spirits to pass to the next stage in their evolution, which was to become devas, they had to give proof of their proficiency at one of these gatherings. Providing they satisfied a council of examiners, they were changed from nature spirits into devas, with more responsible duties. He said that the younger egos evolved along one of three special lines of work: one, the power line, working through music and color; two, the guidance of the vegetable kingdom, which derived its change and progress from experiments made to at the astral level by members of the Deva evolution; and three, work in connection with the human kingdom. He explained that the nature spirits mixed quite frequently with human beings, particularly children. They often played with those who came to the astral world at an early age and taught them how to make use of the plastic astral matter, so to live their fairy stories in very truth, by changing at will so as to represent any figure of fiction for so long as required and so long as the thoughts of those taking part lasted. It was impressed on me that this sphere of the astral world is for the Deva kingdom what the physical world is for the human kingdom. Between lives, birds return to this fourth sphere, the same way that animals inhabit the sixth and seventh spheres, when they are awaiting their return to the world. Birds, as well as fish, butterflies and many other winged creatures, eventually change into nature spirits and are part of the Deva evolution. They never become part of the human evolution. At this stage a group emerged from a nearby coppice. If ever I had imagined the fairy story of the magic carpet come to life, surely this was it. The group consisted of two central figures, both seated cross-legged on what can only be described as a ceremonial carpet, floating about a yard above the ground. From each front corner, strands of flowers were held in the beaks of numerous birds of every color imaginable, and whilst these flew ahead, seemingly pulling the carpet along, the other devas taking part in the procession floated majestically on either side of it. More little birds flew backwards and forwards, dropping rose petals in the path of the procession, each bird swooping down to the ground, picking a petal with its beak from the rose bushes that grew everywhere, and at once returning to its position ahead of the procession, from where the petal was dropped. Whilst the procession slowly wended its way, the air was filled with the notes issuing from the throats of thousands of birds of all types. The procession reached its destination and the two central figures were escorted to the special thrones prepared for them on the dais. The first of the two figures was the chief and the second was the high priest, judging from the ceremonial robes that he wore. As the other officials took their place on the dais, our guide presented Daphne and me to the chief, who intimated that we were to seat ourselves on the platform. Daphne was offered a seat on his right hand and I was given a seat to the immediate left of the high priest. Before the ceremony proper commenced, some music was played by a large orchestra, composed entirely of devas. It was of an extremely cheerful and melodious character. After the orchestra had finished playing, there was silence again. Even the myriads of birds uttered no sound whatever. A herald then entered the inner circle and with a small silver trumpet proclaimed the first part of the ceremony. A small group of nature spirits came into the arena. Although no words were spoken, a question passed from the principal examiner to this group. It related to the expressions of sounds, as representing a slowly moving river, lazily passing through wooded country with tall trees on either side of the riverbank. At once the group produced wind instruments and a curious sort of guitar. They commenced to play and I saw the thought form slowly take shape, showing exactly what they were endeavoring to illustrate through sound. This was immediately followed by another order to produce music that expressed the elements. At once the instruments were changed, several drums, one set of cymbals and two other larger and quite unusual wind instruments, rather like oboes, were introduced. Again they played and it was not difficult to realize, even without looking at the thought form so clearly outlined before us, that a stormassy was the subject of the theme then played. One could almost hear the creaking of the stays and halyards, strained to their utmost by the force of the gale. Thunder and lightning played their part and as this group finished, the crowd stood up as a body, raising their hands to the sky, instead of clapping and cheering, as we would do. That was the entire first group was asked to do and I was sure the members had successfully passed their test. The second group was now heralded into the circle. There were only five of them. They were asked to demonstrate the result of certain grafting, as related to both flowers and shrubs and to different kinds of fruit. The answers appeared immediately as thought form pictures showing very clearly the changes in size and color. They were also asked what kinds of flowers could be grown together in one bed and which kinds meant death to one or more of the species. Then questions concerning crop rotation and why it was necessary. This second group also seemed to satisfy both examiners and crowd. The silver trumpet sounded again and the third group of very small nature spirits then entered the circle and thought forms of three human children were created by the examiners. They were typical airhead English children of an age between 5 and 7. They discussed the fairy story of Cinderella. At once they were joined by the nature spirits who entered into the spirit of the game. They argued as to who should take the principal part and when this was settled I noticed that the nature spirits took over the parts that children usually object to play, they became the ugly sisters, and the unpleasant father, leaving the parts of Cinderella, the fairy godmother and the prince for the children. A short version of the play was enacted, but the transformation scenes covering the fairy carriage and the change of Cinderella's clothes were much more realistic than anything that has ever been produced under physical plane conditions. I imagine the unselfishness shown by the little nature spirits made the difference between passing or failing the test. After a short interval, with cheerful music, all the members of the three groups who had been examined were called back into the arena. The herald sounded the entrance on his silver trumpet. The examiners grouped round the chief and high priest then drew together, as if to confer on what they had seen, and after a few moments the chief examiner stood before the chief and obtained his consent for the nature spirits to be promoted to Deva rank. The high priest then rose to his feet, bowed to the chief and solemnly walked into the area where the nature spirits were standing. For the first time words were used. The high priest, raising his hands above his head, intoned an invocation in the same unknown language I had heard in the glade on the third sphere. The herald then handed him a large sword, the blade of which shone brightly in the clear astral light. Raising it towards the sky, he uttered more words and slowly walked towards the first of the nature spirits, who stood in one long line in front of him. He placed the sword on the head of the first and said two words, which seemed to mean God go with thee, though why I thought this, I do not know, and as I watched, the form of the nature spirit which had appeared to be that of a little old man, changed to that of a young girl. The same thing happened to all the graduates. Some male nature spirits became male devas, whereas others changed their sex. All the newly created bodies were young in appearance. I was about to thank the chief for the wonderful opportunity, offered to us when, without any warning, I felt my body calling me and I found myself awake in bed in Colombo. On the following Saturday night when I got out of my body, I found Jim, the astral helper I had met in the London hospital, waiting for me. He had come to ask for my help. He stated that he had been very impressed by the way I had handled the case of the girl whose name was Mary on Thursday night, and felt I could give further help. This girl had learned from a thoughtless visitor that her mother had been killed in the raid and was so upset that no one could do anything with her. As there was a young sister, Irene, aged 7, it would be a tragedy if Mary died too. I was only too glad to have this opportunity of putting into practice what I had recently learned. When we reached the ward, I saw Mary's fever-racked body tossing on the bed, whilst the girl herself was pacing the ward, metaphorically tearing her hair. She welcomed my arrival, and as I talked soothingly to her, quieted down. I made a thought form of a comfortable city, and whilst we sat there, I gave her what help I could from the knowledge which had been given me by Acharya. I brought the conversation round to Irene and pointed out how she would suffer if both her mother and sister died. I assured Mary, with an authority I did not possess, that she could live, if she made the effort, and if she elected to do so she would still be able to contact her mother during sleep. She asked me if I would help her. I promised to do so and thus took on myself a measure of responsibility. I said I would return the following night. On the Sunday night Mary was waiting for me and was quite calm. I suggested we look for her mother. I showed her how easy it was to travel under astral conditions, and soon this method of progress both interested and intrigued her. She took me to the block of flats where they lived. We found Irene in a neighbor's flat, and by her beside her mother was sitting endeavoring to comfort the weeping child who could not see her. At first the mother thought Mary was dead too, but when she realized this was not the case and that she would be able to care for Irene, she calmed down. I left the three of them to chat and, after arranging to meet them there later, returned to the hospital. I watched Jim and his colleagues working, and made notes of their methods. When Mary, her mother and Irene came in, I spent the rest of my night trying to help them in the way Acharya had helped me. The mother was not a very highly evolved person. I had learned from an astral helper that it had taken 2 days to persuade her to make the effort of will to disconnect herself from her etheric body. At last she seemed to grasp that the link with her family was not broken and that she would still see them at night. This made her much happier. I fancy she will be quite content with first sphere conditions for some time. My last act before returning to my body was to use what willpower I possessed to impress upon Irene that when she awakened she must remember something of what she had been told during her sleep. Chapter 10. Acharya arrived on the stroke of 11 o'clock, as I had expected he would. First of all, he asked me to give him the record of my experiences during the past week. He read through this very carefully before commencing to speak. As he read, his expression showed more and more his appreciation of my efforts, so I was not at all surprised when he said, "I must really congratulate you on all that you have done during the past 7 nights. My leaving you to work on your own at this early stage of your training was a gamble, but the results have proved that I was not wrong in thinking that you were ready to take over a little responsibility, even though your tuition had lasted such a relatively short time. I am indeed happy that was chosen as an instrument to alleviate the distress, which was exceedingly apparent when we first met. There is very little that requires comment in your experiences of last Monday night. A colored movie film is frequently utilized by permanent inhabitants of the astral world for the purpose of displaying pictures of particular places they wish to show to their friends so that they need not burden their memories unduly with the scene they wish to show. To use the astral counterpart of a photographic film is an even simpler method, and providing the operator has brought over with him the technical knowledge, the results are identical with what a similar show would be in the world. I am satisfied that you realize it is extremely unlikely that Charles will want to leave the part of the astral plane in which he is now living, for a considerable time. Then there is your experience of Wednesday night, when all that you remembered took the form of a nightmare. You have already inquired from Daphne whether she had any recollection of taking part in your dream, and she has assured you that, so far as she is aware, she did not have any part in it, and you can rest assured this statement is correct, for there are no periods in her life in the astral world when she loses consciousness and so would not be sure of what she had done. In order that you may understand my explanation of this occurrence, I want you to take your mind back to a previous talk. In it I told you that the perfected men or masters give instruction to pupils in certain circumstances. I shall give you a very brief outline of the work of these pupils. There are two grades of pupils, one called probationary and the other accepted. The only difference between the two is that once a pupil has been accepted by a master, he is, as it were, taken on the permanent staff and utilized for this work not only in his present life but both after death and in lives that are to come. A probationary pupil is tried out, and only after he has served in that capacity for possibly several lives is he taken into the very much closer touch with the master that one finds with accepted pupils. At no time is any compulsion used, for even the masters have no authority to interfere with the free will which is given to every man at the moment of individualization, but before a human being can be utilized for occult work by these great beings, he must show that he has eradicated completely the emotion of fear from his makeup and must prove that at all times he is willing to sacrifice himself in the interest of the work. It is necessary for the student to pass 5 astral tests. These are usually remembered by him in the form of dreams or nightmares. I have been given authority to tell you that your determination to overcome the difficulties of understanding astral plane conditions has been noticed by one of these masters, and it is possible that, in the fullness of time, you will be given the opportunity of serving the White Brotherhood, to which he belongs. This means that you will probably be taken on as a probationary pupil. The dream you had on Wednesday night was actually an astral test, through which you passed quite successfully. The test was to prove that, although obviously you were frightened by the gorilla-like creature, actually a thought form created by the master concerned, yet you were willing to forget yourself and if necessary make the supreme sacrifice, in order to protect what was only a thought form of Daphne, but which was an intense reality to you. Had you refused to make an effort to save her, you would have returned to your body a little earlier than you actually did with the same memory of a nightmare, but in that case you would have failed and proved to the master, who was watching you at the time, that you were unsuitable and insufficiently advanced in evolution for the purpose he had in mind. In the course of the next few years you will probably find that you remember further dreams. These will be more astral tests, all of which you must pass before you can qualify for the work proposed for you. As a personality you know very little about such things, but the real you, the ego, knows perfectly well what is happening, and he, I happen to know, is very keen indeed to make the grade and be used for the helping of humanity. Because of the interest you have shown in the instruction I have given you, I shall give you a rough idea of what you have to accomplish before you can qualify for this special work. You have to know how to move about quickly and effectively on all the different planes of the astral world. You have to know all about the lower astral entities, including those which have etheric bodies, such as the elementals you saw at the bottom of the sea, and must be trained so that the hypnotic effect of the eyes of such creatures has no effect on you. There is a fire test, taking the shape of a fierce forest fire, which you must walk through without fear and with unhurried steps. This sounds easy but is not so easy at the time. The terrific heat, which you feel in your astral body in the same way that a physical fire of similar dimensions would be felt, is likely to terrify you and make you think that you would be destroyed if you attempted to pass through it. Once you realize that because you are in your astral body you cannot be harmed, you calmly walk through the fire and the test has been passed. There is a water test, which teaches you to travel under the sea, and you would be surprised at the number of students who fail that. They succumb to a feeling of suffocation, due entirely to imagination but which nevertheless produces fear. This drives them back to their physical bodies and they awake, realizing that they have had a bad dream. You have to satisfy the master who is interested in you that you can differentiate between a permanent inhabitant of the astral world and one who is sojourning there during a sleep period. You must prove that you have developed the sympathetic understanding, which enables you to work in conjunction with the members of the Deva evolution. Cooperation with them is often necessary in this work.